for the schedule, I'd like to invite Paloma Lobos Garcia. She's also in the ComNet, just been very fundamental in moving this data collection forward, and I'm very happy to be working with her on a paper to look at heterogeneity in firms, reallocation, and effects in the business cycle, a one business cycle. We're going to have, I guess, 11 minutes?
Okay.
11 minutes. After that, I'd like to open the discussion about the two papers, have 5 to 10 minutes on that, and then I want to ask the two discussants to each give their intervention about 15, 20 minutes with an ensuing discussion about those topics. The coffee break at the end is at 4:30. We can go 5 minutes later or so, but not much more. I'm sure people have trains and planes to catch. The policy panel won't wait for us. So, Paloma, the floor is yours.
So, good afternoon, everybody. I really feel like one of these spontaneous that jump into the football, you know, field, and then they are dragged away by the police because they are not, you know, they were not in the program. So I really feel like this. I'm expecting the ECB security to drag me away in any minute. Anyway, so thank you, Eric, for giving me the opportunity to present here, which is really scary. I mean, before this distinguished public. So what I'm going to do is to put a disclaimer, you know, up front, which is any nonsense I'm saying is Eric's fault. So basically.
Well,
and I'm going to take 1 minute from my 11 minutes to talk a little bit more about the ComNet database. Basically, this was the work of 2 years, me as a coordinator, but many people involved, both at the ECB and at the National Central Banks. Basically, the exercise was quite complex because we were drawing from firm-level data available and sitting in the national central banks. This data is confidential, so we could not see it. So basically, we were writing all these codes and programs in order to get our moments within a given country, sector, and year without seeing the data and without the possibility of repeating the exercise in order to correct mistakes. So this was quite challenging, but I have to say that after 2 years of struggling, and despite the different accounting rules in different countries, despite the different samples, despite the different policy priorities and research priorities in the different 17 different national central banks, I think we got a database which is at the country sector year level, but with lots of information within each of the sectors on full distribution of many interesting indicators as well as joint distributions. So this database has to be tested. This database has to be expanded and updated. And in order to do that, we need people like you to use it. So this is really a call for you to start using this data and tell us what we can do better. And now I'm going to go to this paper, which is basically another paper on reallocation. So I'm sure you're wondering why on earth I'm presenting. So the thing is the following. We know a lot already about reallocation of resources across production units. We know that this is the result of firms expanding, shrinking, entering the market and exiting. We know that it is productivity enhancing when all these flows are from low productive to high productive firms. We know that during recessions, the opportunity cost of reallocation is decreasing, but you know there may be frictions in the markets that are altering this cost-benefit balance. But you know what? Most of these we know from the United States. And not only that, we know that for the manufacturing sector, we know that for the within-sector resource reallocation, and we know these 4 periods before the Great Recession. So Eric, Giorgio, and I thought that actually we could add something to this literature, and that's why we started looking at this data for European countries. So what data are we using? Very, very quick, because I only have nine minutes now. So we are using one part of the ComNet database that is called the labor module and also the markup module. Basically, what we have is the following. For each country, sector, and year, we have the share of firms that are in a given quantile of the size distribution at T-3 and move to another quantile of the size distribution at T3 years later. These are the transition matrices, and they are available at the country, sector, and year. So what we do, we also know many, many things of all these firms in each of the cells of the transition matrix at T-3. We know their initial size, initial productivity, initial TFP, access to finance, cash flow, profits. We know many things. So what we're going to do is to imagine or to identify firms in each of these cells of the transition matrix as a representative firm. So we're going to have a representative firm with given initial characteristics and a given employment growth between T minus 3 and T. And this is basically the unit of measurement or the firm we're going to use in our analysis. Now, important to notice that we only have firms that were in at T minus 3 and at T in our sample. So these are surviving firms. We cannot say anything about entry and exit of firms. This is a problem. Anyway, with this, we have a very good coverage for 10 countries, and we have 9 macro sectors. This is manufacturing, construction, and we have 7 service sector. We have coverage between 95 and 2012, but very good coverage from 2001 or 2000 and 2012. So let me talk a little bit about reallocation and the cycle. So here, what we have is a very, very simple regression in which I have the sector job creation rate and the sector job destruction rate. I'm pulling all countries together. And the sector reallocation. And I'm regressing this against an indicator of the cycle and the interaction of this indicator with the Great Recession, which is a dummy taking the value 1 from 2008 onwards. So what I find is that job destruction is indeed pro-cyclical and job creation is counter-cyclical. But and this is different from the United States. Job creation is reacting more to the cycle than job destruction in Europe, which means that reallocation is going to be counter-cyclical. Which, I mean, at the beginning I was a bit puzzled, but then I thought, well, labor market regulations are not the same in the United States and Europe, so maybe this can explain that basically what is varying when there are demand shocks or supply shocks is job creation more than job destruction. But you know what? In the Great Recession, this is changing. Job destruction is becoming much more pro-cyclical. Job creation is not changing. So reallocation is changing the sign. So reallocation over the Great Recession in Europe has become pro-cyclical. But this is not the most interesting thing, because shuffling resources from one firm to the other is interesting, but what we want to see is that these resources are going from low to high productive firms. So this is the productivity enhancing reallocation of resources. So we're going to start with a between sector reallocation of resources. We heard some complaints yesterday that normally we look at the within sector reallocation of resources. So here you are, some between sector reallocation of resources. Very simple regression again. We have sector job creation rates, sector job destruction rates, and sector net employment creation. And we're going to regress these indicators against the initial relative productivity of the sector. This is the relative productivity of the sector vis-a-vis the country average. So just I'm seeing whether relatively more productive sectors are creating or destroying more jobs than other sectors. So this is what I find. Basically, this is the coefficient of this relative initial productivity of the sector interacted with a full set of year dummies. So what I find is that net employment creation was not related to the relative productivity of the sector in the pre-crisis period. But from 2008 onwards, the job creation starts taking place only in the relatively more productive sectors. So it's only from 2008 onwards that basically there is a productivity enhancing between sector reallocation. Job destruction, the correlation between job destruction and the relative productivity of the sectors is basically not changing over time. Now, the next thing we do is to look at the within sector resource reallocation. So here we take the our representative firm's employment growth, and we are going to regress it against the initial productivity of these firms, at T minus 3, relative to the average productivity of firms in the same sector. So what we find is that this relative initial productivity of the firm, it's correlated positively and very significantly with employment growth of the firm. But this positive correlation is actually declining over time. So this is the blue line. The other thing we see is that if we run this regression only taking into account firms with more than 20 employees, which in Europe is medium to large firms, what we find is that the correlation is much weaker, although it's still positive and significant, and it doesn't change over time. The next thing we do is to wonder whether this correlation between the initial productivity of the firm and its employment creation in the next 3 years, whether this correlation is different across sectors. So what we do is a very simple exercise in which we interact the initial productivity of the firm with a full set of sector dummies. And what we find is that this productivity enhancing reallocation is maximum, is the highest in the manufacturing sector and in the trade sector, and is the lowest, significantly lower, in the ICT construction and the professional services sector. This professional service sector is this professional technical services, which is basically lawyers, auditors, accountants, all these type of, all these services that in Europe are extremely regulated. So that means entry is controlled, so you can only operate in this service sector if you have certain diplomas and certificates, and the tariffs are regulated. It's a very heavily regulated sector. So we were wondering, so why can we find these significant differences across sectors in terms of this productivity enhancing reallocation? So we did another very simple exercise, which is basically take the sector markups that I estimated in the markup module, and I want especially to thank Anna. Hi, Anna, from the Bank of Portugal, who is hiding, and she provided us with these sector markups. So basically, these are price cost margins, the weighted average price cost margin of all firms operating in a given country, sector, and year. So what we are doing is taking the deviation of a given sector price cost margin vis-a-vis the average price cost margin in the country in a given year, and we are interacting our productivity, initial productivity of the firm, with this deviation. So what we want to see is whether the correlation between the initial productivity of the firm and the employment growth is stronger or weaker in sectors with a relatively higher markup. And this is what we find. We find that the interaction is negative. Actually, if you sum the coefficients, they become negative if you look at the set of firms that have more than 20 employees. So it seems that for the medium and large firms that are operating in sectors with relatively higher markups, the productivity enhancing reallocation is lower than for firms operating in other sectors. And if you go for the full sample, which is all firms with more than one employee, this is not the case. The next thing we are doing, but this is work in progress, so I'm not presenting it, is trying to see whether we can replicate this type of exercise, but using some sector measure of collective bargaining power or labor market regulation, as well as access to finance. So again, we want to see whether sectors with more, presence of centralized collective bargaining, for example, or more exposed to labor market regulation, this cleansing, this productivity enhancing reallocation is lower. So we have started working with a markup module with Anna again. We got some time invariant collective bargaining parameter. So far, we have not identified any significant effect, but we are still working on that. And we are also working in the financial or access to finance direction. We already tried with an indicator we have constructed in Comnet of access to finance of firms. So basically, we are seeing whether in sectors where there is a relatively higher share of firms with difficulties to access external finance, this cleansing is lower because they cannot grow even if they are productive. And the initial results is indeed that it seems that this is the case, but they are not entirely robust, so I'm not showing them. And I think I...
Yes. Thank you very much.
Oops. Switch it off.
Uh-oh. All right, so let's see if we can get some questions from the audience for the paper presenters, comments on the paper presenters and discussions, and then get responses from the two paper presenters, and then we can go with the interventions. Any on the trade elasticities or the learning? Yes. collect some questions in because of the time. Any other? Yes, Kalina. Others, Chad. Or cumulative sales. Yeah. So you can condition the growth on the cumulative sales rather than on age. Should we take it in the order of the discussion? Do you want to comment?
Okay.
Respond to your discussion.
So thank you very much, Fabio. We already talked a bit during the break. So sorry for sending you ex ante paper, which was a bit incomplete because part, especially the last part and some of the tests we are doing in the paper were not there. So sorry again for that. So I feel that there is still a long way for this paper, this specific paper, to be able to really be able to talk to the people which are really simulating these macro models, international macroeconomic models. So thank you very much for the reference you sent. Especially, I think that's the translog paper you were mentioning with me. I think it's going to be really useful for us, and we're going to read carefully because I think that we can learn a lot from this paper. I think we also do not take into account, that's true, this cross product elasticity within country, which is another parameter which is could actually influence those macro elasticities. So we need to find a trick for that as well as, and you were also, we were talking to during the break, you know, the fact that these elasticities in certain frameworks such as Melit and Taviano, they are also state dependent, they can change also with the market conditions, and so we are kind of controlling for such of these factors. So we have sector times country fixed effects, since we are in growth equations, we control for the long term. We have also control for short-term variations in labor productivity or TFP of the firm, but there might be other controls that we may want to add in these specifications to control for these fluctuations into the market conditions and really have a clean estimation of the of these elasticities. So, and definitely Ave should talk to Flor.
Yeah. So first, thanks, James, too, for the discussion and all these comments. So one first thing, and which is related also to the question, which is the relationship between active and passive learning. Clearly, what we have in the model, so. The test we do, Erikson and Pex, is just a test that shows that there is some passive learning, but it does not rule out the fact that there are alternative processes. So clearly, this is something. We cannot really, we don't have firm information, and so we don't have firm level information. But one thing which is, and in fact it came out quite late in the paper, is the behavior of prices. So what we have on the prices, which are unit values, so this is something important to remember, but the prices are slightly decreasing over time, and which is something which is not, at least it's difficult to reconcile with lots of model of active learning, in fact. And I'm thinking also about your paper, where you have exactly the other process on the other trend on prices. And this is something that came out quite late in the paper, but this is actually in line with this passive learning mechanism. So It just indicative evidence of passive learning, but it could be that there is something else, and all the fixed effect we have may also be capturing some of this marketing expenses, etc. So this is something maybe we should try to see whether alternative process would affect our the way we measure this belief and we separate belief and demand. And clearly, thanks for all the comments on, in particular, the statistical property of the model, and we should check this much more clearly. And so we have worked quite a lot on some of the assumptions, but not that much on this what implies, what the model implies, and what the methodology implies. So we should be more careful on this, and also on the selection effect. So we try to use a balanced panel most of the time to test the robustness of the results. But even with a balanced panel, it's not completely immune from the selection, because by definition, and this is what we show at the end of the paper when we focus on the exit decision, there is some selection. So even with a balanced panel, we have some selection. So we should maybe think a bit more about this. And regarding on the variance of quantities, in fact, in the model, you don't really need to have the same prior for all the firm at the beginning when they enter. So you could allow firm to have different prior. And so this is in fact what we allow, and what we find is that for a given cohort of exporter, the variance of quantities do decrease with over time. So this would go more with the fact that the prior belief are heterogeneous and not biased. The fact is it's not biased, but This is on our research agenda. How does this belief, this initial belief, is made by the firm? And so I guess they are learning across market, across product, from competitors. So this is something we really like to investigate. Thanks.
I'd like to invite Jim to the floor. That was what we had. Was that the sorry? That That was the. I thought that was the order that we had. That there were comments from you. That came.
So Eric asked
15, 20 minutes. Okay. Don't worry.
Eric asked me to speak about how trade fictions condition the response of exports to business cycle effects and maybe monetary policy. Those are two phrases I don't think I've ever put in any paper I've ever written. And so I was concerned because I'm speaking here at the ECB, and there's going to be policymakers there, and they might make the mistake of thinking I knew what I was talking about. So I decided to ignore Eric and just focus on more familiar territory and address things from a micro perspective and just talk about what the main firm-level trade frictions are, that at least that I've been focusing on, and what are the drivers of selection in the foreign market and post-entry growth. Now, I started working on that stuff a long time ago with Mark Roberts when we focused on threshold costs, breaking into markets, and the underlying stochastic processes that drive costs and demand. But for the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working with Jonathan Eden and a few others on the formation and evolution of international buyer-seller relationships. So even though Andy said this was totally new, we've been working on this for a while. So I want to talk about some hopefully relevant stuff that's coming out of that work. I want to talk about some descriptive results, and then I'll summarize quickly some dynamic models and then move to their implications for export dynamics. So You guys have already seen several times what we know about participation in export markets. Every year, there's a massive wave of new exporters showing up. They're almost all tiny. Almost all of them leave after a year. But the small core of each cohort that sticks around grows very rapidly. I was going to show you some old slides I have on that, but I'll spare you spare myself the embarrassment and just skip right to the more interesting stuff, which has to do with international buyer-seller matches. Now, with customs records in the United States or in Colombia, you can see identifications for both the buyer and the seller. Exports coming from Colombia into the United States, the seller ID, that is the ID of the person in Colombia, is a name and address, so there's going to be some noise in that. We're not going to get this exactly right. But I think we've done a fairly good job of identifying when a particular buyer and seller get together and identifying the subsequent transactions in that relationship. You can do the same thing with the Colombia data. Anyway, if we call a match, a buyer and seller getting together for the first time in the data, and we say the match is enduring until they haven't had a transaction for a year, then what we discover is that there are some striking patterns. Now, this graph is more detailed than what I really need. Just focus on any one of those lines. The top one is the matches that start in the smallest size quartile. And what that diagram tells you is 80% of the matches, which are less than 1 year old, don't last for more than a year. If it's the largest quintile or quartile, about 50% will survive to the second year. And the death rates fall somewhat after the first year as matches mature, but you can see they remain very high. So most matches are very short-lived, 1 to 2 years, and only a small handful make it past that. The other thing I wanted to stress is, just focus on the top left quadrant there. Again, this is more detail than you need. That's the matches that started in the smallest size quartile. If you look at the far right set of bars, that's the sales in the first year, second, third, fourth, and fifth year. And you can see that after the first year, sales don't grow for an individual match. The first year is smaller because, on average, you're going to see a part of a year of a relationship, not a full year. So the punchline is that if you want to grow in the U.S. market, or any market for that matter, I think these are general patterns, you can't grow by finding one sugar daddy who's going to place more and more orders with you over time. You have to grow by adding clients. And furthermore, you're going to be losing clients quickly, according to our previous graph. So not only do you have to be replacing the ones which are dropping off, if you're going to grow, you have to be adding them at even more rapid rate. And that's why we see this this Pareto-like distribution of clients across exporters. This is a log-log scale. So on the left-hand side, the first dot is the log of the fraction of exporters who have at least one client. Of course, the log of one is zero, which is why it's up there. But you can see that as we move to higher and higher log client numbers, then we lose buyers. We lose exporters very quickly. So it's almost exactly a Pareto distribution. If you look at things from the Colombian side, you don't have the problem with censoring out of the Census Bureau, so you can see them all. And right at the right-hand tail there, you can see that it does start to drop off low. So it's not exactly Pareto, but it's close. And that's true for distribution of buyers across sellers and distribution of sellers across buyers. That's what those two graphs are. The final thing I wanted to show you right now is that if you're an exporter, on average, you're going to tend to lose clients over time. On the left-hand axis there is sellers in period T. Right-hand is period T plus 1. Almost all the mass of that joint distribution is to the left of the diagonal. So you tend to lose clients regardless of how big you are. And that's why it's so hard to end up there out there with 35 or 40 clients, which is the top of the distribution. So we've been trying to develop first of all, there are lots of other papers which have tried to explain this in the tradition of this conference. I'll click past that slide. We've been trying to develop models which explain those stylized facts. And the first generation of model we developed, this was with Jonathan, Marcela Slava, David Jenkins, and C.J. Creason. The first model is a single-agent model. And there we assume firms engage in costly search to meet potential buyers. both in their home market and in the foreign market. They know the scope of the demand for their products at home, but they don't know what fraction of potential buyers abroad are interested in their product. So every time they meet another buyer, the buyer says, oh, yes, I like your product. Or he says, well, I'm a flower shop and that's a jet engine, so probably not. So it, as you meet more and more of these people, then you get a better sense for the fraction of the market there. And that's a sense in which there's learning going on. Now, as you learn, you adjust your search intensity because it's costly and cost functions convex. So firms that get positive signals ramp up their search intensity. They invest more in search. Firms get negative signals, tuck their tails, and back off the foreign market. The other distinctive feature of this model is we cannot explain that Pareto shape unless we have reputation effects in there. That's to say, if we want to sustain somebody out in that right-hand tail there with tons of clients, it's got to be true that the cost per client is low. How do we get that? Well, we say the more clients you meet, the easier it is to find the next client, or the less costly it is to find the next client. And we estimate a parameter for this reputation effect, which allows us to match that distribution. And then finally, these distributions break apart for both endogenous and exogenous reasons. So this model explains the large volume of small-scale exporters just because of there's this big mass of Colombian firms out there, and they're all searching at some very low level. All you have to do is put up a website in English, and you're in the market, right? So if it's cheap to search at a low level, and given our convex cost function, it will be, this large body of low-level searches is going to yield matches for some fraction of those guys. But then when they get in the market, it's kind of an aberration, and their match isn't going to last very long, so none of them do, and they're gonna jump out. So that's how we get the large turnover among the small-scale exporters. The high exit rate partly reflects the fact that, on average, these guys aren't that appealing as exporters, and partly that many of them are going to get negative signals about their product and back off their search intensity. And then, as I already said, the major exporters are going to come from the reputation effects, as well as the fact that we allow the distribution across sellers of product appeal to be skewed. Okay, so that was the first paper, still not in final form, as we keep revising it, and it takes forever every time we do it to re-estimate. But that didn't stop us from starting another paper, which is in preliminary stages. And here we're moving away from a single agent setting to a market equilibrium setting. And it's more of a network paper. The idea eventually is to ask, what if we yank all the Chinese out of the network? How does the network reform? Who are the winners and losers? Or suppose we dump a new country, North Korea. Let's dump it into the United States and see how that affects the network. The other thing we want to do is ask how equilibria depend upon the matching frictions. If the matching frictions are severe, what are the patterns that we see? What are the welfare costs? Now, this differs from the first model, not in that we have a different cost of search function. We still have convex search costs for hazards of arrival rates, and we still have reputation effects. But now we have something we borrowed from the labor literature, which is indices of market tightness. We also have a parameter that governs the efficiency with which buyers and sellers meet each other. So here we've got a richer setting which allows us to do much more. The other thing that's new to this model is we have to write down a payoff function which tells us how much the buyers and sellers who are party to a new match are going to get. And that payoff function takes as arguments lots of things. Each party to the match has an idiosyncratic profit shifter, but each party also has a unique product line. Looking at the history of goods that the exporters have exported, we can identify the goods that they're capable of supplying. We just assume that's revealed by history. And we look at the buyers and look at what products they've ever imported and say that's a set of products that are capable of supplying. And then we can calculate the probability that any match between a vector of buyer characteristics and vector of seller characteristics is going to result in a successful match. So depending upon who you meet, you may be well-suited or ill-suited for that particular match. And that's what I mean by compatibility of buyers and sellers. The other thing that affects the payoff function is how many exporters have already matched with that buyer. If you're the first one, well, you're going to be critical, whereas if lots of other sellers have already matched with the buyer, you're not going to get as much rent out of that probably. And So all those things figure into this model. The objective here is that we want to match not only the patterns we match with the single agent model, but also some network features. And to, I don't know how I'm doing on time.
We've got 10 at least.
A little slower. So let me introduce some concepts from the network. There's a very basic. We're going to think about a Colombian importer First of all, I'm thinking now as Colombia being the destination market. And the reason is for the application of this model we're using, we're looking at imports of consumer electronics into Colombia. Why? Because Colombia doesn't produce many consumer electronics, so we can see almost the whole network just by looking at imports coming to wholesalers and retailers. Okay, so back to this. A Colombian importer or a foreign exporter of consumer electronics from anywhere is a node in the network, and an edge between two nodes occurs when they do business with each other. And we say firms are connected if you can trace a path from one firm to another firm through these shared edges. And then finally, a component is a set of connected firms. Now, if you look at the Colombian consumer electronics market, you'll see that the value of imports doubled between 2003 and 2012. So it's increased tremendously. But interestingly, some characteristics of the network have remained quite stable. The fraction of firms that are in the largest component has been stable at 86%. And the percent of value in that largest component has been stable at 53%. So those are big numbers. That's kind of a small world property. It means that there's this very connected community of firms that deal in consumer electronics in Colombia. And it also suggests if you pull one of those major players out, you're going to disturb the market in a serious way. The other thing I want to point out is everybody else is small potatoes. There are about 1,900 components of size one. So you've got this big lump, and then everybody else is marginal. Now here is a graph of the network where the closer these things, each dot is a node, and the closer those things are together, the more edges they share. We've colored those nodes, so the red one is reflects imports from the United States, the green one reflects China, and you can see that they're clustered by source, and that's one of the reasons that we see that going on. Okay, so how do we match the data? Well, the matching of the degree distribution, that Pareto shape, is similar to in the single agent model. The clustering patterns are matched because we have this product mix compatibility feature in there, as well as we have firms getting big because of the reputation effects and heterogeneity in firm types. So that's how we match those two network features. We really haven't done a serious job of estimating this, so I don't want you to take this very seriously, but we did it anyway. We said, well, suppose we increase the measure of sellers who are active in this market. What happens in terms of the rents generated by the matches? Well, they more than double, because when you've got a dense network like that, then these reputation effects kick in more seriously, and those scale economies are important. It's also true that if you increase the matching frictions, initially it doesn't seem to matter much, but there's a tipping point beyond which the frictions cause it to kind of fall off a cliff. And if you make things much more, make it much more difficult for firms to get together, then suddenly you get much less clustering. I don't know yet whether that's just the functional firms we're using or it's some inherent feature of the model. Okay, so now export dynamics. I could say a little bit about that using the single agent model. One thing we see is that when firms come into the market, there's a slow selection effect where the least effective or the least appealing products slowly disappear from the market. But that takes a long time to weed out the low appeal suppliers, maybe 5 or 10 years. We also see, and this is interesting, there's a lock-in effect. If you're an appealing product and you come in and you get a few, you happen to meet a couple producers who don't like your product, that makes you sad and you go home. But if you're the same person and you come in and somebody says, that's very cool, then that makes you happy and you start searching more and more. And then it gets easier and easier to meet clients because of the reputation effect. So if you just had good luck initially, you can end up one of the big dogs. and there's certain there's a fair amount of remnants there. The guys who are super successful exporters may just have been lucky, at least some of them early on, as compared to ones that didn't make it. And of course, that creates a kind of hysteresis too. So we find that that's important. We also find that learning isn't really that important for the aggregate export dynamics, and the reason is that it takes place mainly among the relatively new marginal players, and they don't really contribute that much to the dynamics, at least in the short run. Well, this just shows you how the distributions shift over time in terms of product appeal. I'm not going to spend much time on this. This is what if we reduced search costs 20%, scaled down that convex cost function. Well, we did that. The red line is the base case. The dotted blue is the counterfactual. We reduced search costs around 2003. You can see that over the next 5 years ago or so, firms ramp up in terms of the number of clients, and we get more exporters participating. That's the top right-hand quadrant there. And so total exports, which is the upper left quadrant, gradually ramp up over about a five-year period. So these things are certainly creating sluggish responses, and to some extent they're also irreversible responses. There's a variant of this model that, surely I'm out of time by now, but if not, I'll keep going. There's a three, all right. So I'm back to talking fast, I can't help it. There's a variant of this model which helps us to understand export booms. And it's particular to a situation we often see in developing countries, where an industry really isn't established in the domestic market, maybe because there's no demand for that industry domestically. Take, for example, Bangladesh Western apparel. Nobody wears Western apparel in Bangladesh, so there was no domestic market for apparel when that industry took off there. Or think about cut flowers coming out of Africa. There really wasn't much demand there. Nonetheless, those are industries that are viable abroad. Now, why don't they take off very often? Well, without pre-existing firms, if you want to export, you can't just redirect your production capacity toward the foreign market. Right? You've got to build a plant. That's a big sunk cost. Furthermore, if you shut down, you can't just sell it to the next guy. You're stuck with your hot house or your garment factory or whatever. So that's a barrier. And also, there's no information about demand conditions abroad being generated by others in your industry, nor do you have information about your idiosyncratic ability. If you've already been operating in the domestic market, you have some sense, well, I'm a good entrepreneur in this industry, I'm a bad entrepreneur. But if there's no existing industry, everybody's a newcomer, right? So everybody's thinking, well, maybe I'm good, maybe I'm bad. There's these big sunk costs. So it's going to take a big push to get these guys in. And furthermore, when they jump in, they're a relatively homogeneous group, right? Because they don't have any idiosyncratic signals. So they're all going to jump in together. And here's a simulation of a model which is parameterized that way, where there's sunk entry costs that you don't get back. Now, here the red line is a real exchange rate, and we just simulated this process. It's just a Markov process, and assumed initially there are no exporters in this particular market. And exporters don't show up until around year 20 or so. It's hard to see it. Let's see if that's any clearer. Yeah, so this orange line here is exporters, and it's just zero up until here when the exchange rate gets high enough. And then everybody says, let's go, boys, and they all jump in together, and you get this discrete jump. Then from there on, then there's the successful guys investing and finding clients and so on. So that's one interpretation for how export booms take place, at least among these industries that weren't already up and running. And once they're in, right? So they're devoting 100% of their output to the foreign market. Their costs are sunk. And so they tend to last a lot longer in export market than industries where there's a domestic market they can fall back to. We have statistics showing this for some Chinese industries as well as Bangladeshi apparel. So that's all I wanted to say about these models. Since Eric suggested I talk a little about data, my closing slide will be data I'd like to have. One limitation with this analysis of networks is you don't see usually, Andy's got it for Norway. I was hoping he'd stick around so I could ask him for the data. You don't see the domestic players in the network, right? So I only see the suppliers coming from abroad. To complete the story for most industries, you need to see them all. So any kind of linkage we could get between domestic firms would be useful. Maybe a board of directors or domestic intermediate input, like commodity flow survey information. I guess in principle it should be possible to do it from value added, but nobody seems to do that. Anyway, you guys are in position to make that happen, so I'll leave it to you.
Another fun project.
What's that?
Another fun project.
Okay. Investment in relationship building. This is something I think we could be able to do. You get to get some surveys on spending on marketing and sales. That would give us a better sense for the cost function that's embedded in these models.
Okay. Well, so thank you very much. I'd like to now invite Fabio, and then we'll probably have some time. I'll have to look at Filippo how much leeway we get for discussion after Fabio is gone. So you have 20 minutes as well.
The trick was that they changed the file names. So I was looking for ironic discussion, and it was changed to something this long. So what I'm going to talk about is the macro and policy implications of structural reforms. So we're really going macro. I'm going to introduce it by starting with a couple of quotes. There what you see is the title of the speech that President Mario Draghi gave in Sintra a few weeks ago. What you see there is a representative or an important sample, at least to me, of what he said. Research suggests that reforms that increase employment flexibility are more likely to depress demand during downturns. I would, however, reject the conclusion that this means all structural reforms should be postponed. The reason is that the short-term impact of reforms does not just depend on when they are implemented, but how they are implemented. And I added emphasis there. It depends also on their interaction with other policy measures. And as President Draghi points out, I would argue that our current monetary stance, in fact, makes accelerating structural reforms desirable because it brings forward their positive effects. Next quote, Paul Krugman some years ago. That's from a 1995 book that Peter Cannon edited, and it's from the conclusion chapter in that book, which was titled What Do We Need to Know About the International Monetary System? And it's essentially a call for research at the intersection of international trade and international macro, or at the intersection of macro and micro, if you wish. And there's an interesting statement there, which is that until we can actually make the two frameworks, the macro one and the micro one, talk to each other, we're making policy advice by the seat of our pants. So let's move on from there. Structural reforms, which are meant to be designed to make product and labor markets more flexible, have been a central theme of this conference and of policy discussions at the highest level. Now, the references that were made on this topic yesterday took mostly a micro perspective, with hints, for instance, to the reallocation effects of such government interventions into the structure of markets. Now, to build on the terminology of some of yesterday's conversations and also on what Gianmarco did this morning, what I'm going to do is try to bring micro to macro and give you some perspective on the macro effects of structural reforms in a macro framework that incorporates micro-level dynamics. And in doing so, I'm going to focus on the interaction between reforms and the monetary policy making environment, which was highlighted by President Draghi, and I will connect also to to the reference that Giancarlo yesterday made to the role of stabilization policy in managing the dynamics triggered by structural reforms. The presentation that I'm going to give you builds on a research agenda that I've been working on with Matteo Cacciatore and Giuseppe Fiori, and now more recently also with Giovanni Aiello, Filippo Di Mauro, and Paolo Mengano here at the ECB, and some others. And a point that I'm going to try to make clear from a methodological standpoint, it is crucial for the macro models that we use to analyze the impact of structural reforms to incorporate micro-level market dynamics in order for these models to yield conclusions that are in line with the narrative of policymakers and to avoid potentially misleading results. So here is, my take on something that has been going on in the macro literature on this topic. So there's a literature that has been developing that basically relies on using the off-the-shelf New Keynesian model to study the impact of product and labor market reforms. An example is a recent Journal of Monetary Economics article that received considerable attention by Goiti Edgardson and Andrea Ferrero and Andrea Raffo. What they do is they use the basic, essentially plain vanilla New Keynesian model with sticky prices and wages, and they model product and labor market reforms very simply, essentially as exogenously slashing price and wage markups. Now, what they show is that this has a positive supply side effect on output, but it also sort of automatically pushes the economy in the direction of deflation. And these markup cuts similarly imply an automatic depreciation of the terms of trade, which induces an improvement in the trade balance. What Goiti and Andrea and Andrea then do is to warn that the deflationary effects of reforms can exacerbate the problem of the zero lower bound on interest rate setting in monetary policy making with unfavorable demand side consequences. Now, this is interesting because we're talking about structural reforms, but at the same time, we're taking a very reduced form approach to modeling structural reforms. It is an approach that has been adopted in a variety of other papers, and it is actually to address the concerns. It is the concerns that are raised by this type of research that essentially President Draghi was responding to in that statement that I quoted. And there's a lot of merit in the exercise that was done in that paper and that is done in other papers. It's a great starting point for discussing the consequences, the macro consequences of reforms in models that are suitable for policy analysis. However, as I pointed out, it is a reduced form approach to structural reforms because the off-the-shelf New Keynesian model does not include any of the product and labor market dynamics that the narrative of policymakers has been focusing on. Right? There is no modeling of producer entry barriers that product market reform would be lowering because there are no producer entry dynamics in the framework. There is no extensive margin of employment with hiring and firing decisions by firms, nor the impact that reforms such as reducing unemployment benefits and worker bargaining power would have on the labor market. And it turns out that incorporating these more micro-level ingredients in the frameworks affects the conclusions pretty drastically, and it brings them closer to the narrative that we hear from policymakers, and to the reasons why they have been calling for structural reforms. So what Matteo Giuseppe and I have been doing is to study the consequences of reforms in models with nominal rigidity that incorporate the traditional New Keynesian nominal rigidity features, but also incorporate micro-level product and labor market dynamics that the policymakers have in mind. This framework builds on the work that I did with Mark in our 2005 paper, and then the work that Mark and I did with Florine. And what we do is we augment that framework with labor market frictions, as in Matteo's work and the work that Matteo then did with Giuseppe in the context of a flex price, flex wage model. So what are the basic ingredients of the framework we use? Well, there's going to be an endogenous producer entry subject to sunk costs. And the assumption is that part of these costs is of technological nature, but part is also the result of inefficient market regulation. And product market reform reduces barriers to producer entry. Labor markets are characterized by search and matching frictions, as in the standard Diamond-Mortensen-Pissarides framework. Firms incur costs of vacancy posting. Workers receive unemployment benefits. Equilibrium wages are determined by Nash bargaining between workers and firms. And labor market reform reduces unemployment benefits and worker bargaining power. In the framework we have been working with so far, we abstract from firing costs to simplify the model. If you want to see versions of this type of framework with firing costs, it's something that is in Matteo's own paper or the paper that Matteo did with Giuseppe or Jim's work with Kerem Kosar and Nezi Gonak. And then, as I said, prices and wages are sticky to have a role for monetary policy. So what do we do with this framework? So we do several applications. So one of them is a paper that's titled Market Deregulation and Optimal Monetary Policy in a Monetary Union. We have a two-country version of the model. It's a monetary union version in which there are two countries, but only one central bank. And we study how these reforms of product and labor markets are going to affect the optimal conduct of monetary policy by the central bank of this monetary union. In addition to the basic ingredients that I gave you above, the model also features something you saw before, a translog expenditure function, because we wanted to have in the model an endogenous flexible price markup such that when you reform product markets, entry of more producers is going to imply that product becomes more closely substitutable and markets endogenously decline. So as opposed to go back to the exercise that is being done with the basic New Keynesian framework, there you are exogenously slashing markups. Here what we are doing is reducing entry barriers. This stimulates product creation, increasing product substitutability, and endogenously over time, the markup declines. What does this imply? What does all this imply for monetary policy? So we start by characterizing optimal monetary policy in an environment of high product market regulation in this monetary union, product and labor market regulation. And what that implies is that it is optimal for monetary policy to depart from price stability, both in terms of average inflation target. The model provides a motive for a positive steady state inflation target. And it is also optimal to deviate from target as you manage monetary policy optimally in response to business cycle shocks. What is driving the conduct of optimal monetary policy? Well, optimal monetary policy in this framework is about narrowing wedges that characterize the decentralized market economy relative to the efficient outcome. And what the central bank of this monetary union is doing is to trade off costs that are created by using inflation against the benefit of addressing suboptimal outcomes in labor and product markets, in particular suboptimally low job creation. What about the response to reforms? it is optimal to expand monetary policy during the transition dynamics that are generated by reforms. And it is optimal to do that by more than would be dictated by a calibrated monetary policy that essentially reproduces historical European central bank behavior. The optimal response of the central bank to reforms in the model, what it does is precisely what President Draghi suggested. It front-loads the eventual longer-term beneficial effects of reforms. It brings them closer to the present. Something that is especially important is that the demand side effects of these reforms, the fact that product market reform, for instance, results in an increase in investment in new business creation, have inflationary effects and do not exacerbate, do not create zero lower bound problems in the conduct of monetary policy. What about the optimal conduct of policy in the post-reform environment? In the post-reform environment, the costs of a narrow focus on price stability are lower. And the reason is that the reforms imply that, most importantly, the most important reason is that the reforms imply that job creation is closer to the efficient outcome in the new steady state and over the business cycle around this new steady state. And therefore, there is less need for monetary policy activism. Now, what about the international effects and an international dimension of reforms? So, in contrast to the reduced form approach to modeling structural reforms, here, if you do a reform of markets in the home country, holding foreign market regulation constant, what that's going to cause is actually the home country to run a current account deficit rather than a surplus, and to experience a terms of trade appreciation rather than depreciation in the first part of the transition. What is going on is that by reducing barriers to business creation, you're generating an incentive in investing in the formation of new business. And what is optimal to do for the home country where this deregulation is happening is to borrow to finance this increase in business creation. Now, in turn, this increase in business creation is going to put upward pressure on labor costs, on domestic labor costs, which is going to push the terms of trade in the direction of appreciation rather than depreciation. Something else that's kind of interesting, or that we find interesting, is that it is desirable to synchronize reforms across countries. The intuition is actually rather obvious, and it is the fact that if you reform only in one country and not in the other, you create a new trade-off for the central bank, for the one central bank of this monetary union. Because reforms in one country and not in the other imply that inflation becomes differently desirable between the two countries. And this creates an additional trade-off for monetary policy making. So it is desirable, actually, to synchronize reforms across countries. Now, we also have another paper, a different paper, where we go back to the basic CS Dixit-Stiglitz framework of my paper with Mark. We introduce heterogeneity across producers and endogenous determination of the set of the trade of traded products, as in the Malitz trade model. And we focus on a two-country framework with flexible exchange rates. And the idea there is, let's take one of the countries as capturing the euro area, and the other is the US. And what happens to this interdependence and to optimal monetary policy for these two areas relative to historical behavior when the euro area makes its markets more flexible? Okay? I'm going to show you a couple of responses. These are the impulse responses to product market reform. The blue lines are the responses that you see. So these are for the home country, the euro area. And the blue lines are the responses that you have under historical policy behavior. So when monetary policy is essentially replicating what the ECB has been doing historically in terms of interest rate setting. The red responses are those that are generated by the optimal monetary policy, which in this framework is the benchmark optimal monetary policy that also implies cooperation between the two central banks of this world economy. So for instance, in the top left corner, you see the response of consumption. Right? The blue line, the historical response, and the red line, over time, in the long term, they are going to converge. But what you see is that in the early phases of the response, the optimal monetary policy generates a more favorable response of consumption relative to historical monetary policy behavior. Same thing is seen, so the next response that you see next to it is GDP. And again, you know, over the long run, the two responses are actually going to essentially coincide. Historical monetary policy behavior is going to imply that in the short run, this product market reform is going to generate a recession in terms of GDP. The optimal monetary policy removes that recession. And again, what it is doing is it is front-loading, it is bringing closer to the implementation phase of the reform the beneficial effects of the reform. Next to it is the response of unemployment, which falls by more under the optimal policy than it does under historical behavior. In the middle line, the first two to the left are the responses of the domestic and export markups. And what you see is that markups fall by more under optimal policy. They fall by more under optimal policy because optimal policy is deviating by more from price stability, and therefore it is eroding markups by the movement of inflation is generating more erosion of markups than historical behavior. Terms of trade appreciate. And the current account is here, bottom right corner, goes into deficit. So you have this stark difference relative to the implications of an exogenous slashing of price markups. Now the model, this version of the model, because it incorporates the Mellitz heterogeneity, makes it possible to draw also some conclusions about what this product market reform is going to imply for average firm productivity versus the average export production, you know, the average export productivity, and the average employment at different types of firms that operate in this economy. And the top left response is the response of average firm productivity in this economy following product market reform. And what you see is that during the transition dynamics, the reform implies an increase in average firm productivity by more if monetary policy is doing the optimal thing. You know, if you are curious, when the slides are online, you can look at what happens when you do product labor market reform or when you do a combination of both product and labor markets. All this, yesterday Kalina mentioned that these product and labor market reforms would generate higher firm productivity. And indeed, this is borne out by this dynamic framework with more beneficial effects if monetary policy is conducted optimally. I want to use just one. So there's a lot that remains to be done. So on the empirical front, the work that I've started, doing with Giovanni and Filippo and Paolo is very interesting. It implies some difference relative to these predictions for the terms of trade and the current account. And the reason is that the measure of product market reform that we have available in the data is actually very different from what we're doing in the model. And it is a measure of reform in the upstream, non-traded service sector. And that is going to translate actually in a reduction in costs in the downstream final tradable production sector, and therefore an improvement in the external balance, but for reasons that are very different from the reduced form approach. Something else that I think is first order to look at in this agenda that I'm very interested in exploring in the future is the issue of optimal product market reform, optimal product and labor market reforms. So in this literature, the exercises that we're doing, both the reduced form modeling of structural reforms and what we are doing, we're not looking at optimized market reforms. We are setting initial values of these market characteristics to replicate the current characteristics of the euro area. And then we are adjusting these market characteristics to the corresponding US levels, with the idea of taking the US as a benchmark flexible product and labor markets. But there is no presumption that these US levels of these market characteristic parameters should be optimal for the model euro area, or even for the model US for that matter. And so it's very, a crucial question to address is to actually start thinking about optimal product and labor market reforms, and in work with Sanjay Chug that we do on optimal fiscal policy in this kind of model, we actually have some results that provide insights into optimal product market reforms. That opens up a whole new set of questions, however, because once you have that market regulators are optimizing, then you also need to address the issue of the strategic interaction between product and labor market regulators, the government of the countries we're talking about, with the central bank. And that creates a whole set of interesting questions. We've actually been kind of seeing that kind of game play out at many points over the last few years, and I think it's going to be fascinating to explore it also in a rigorous framework. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My remark from the end of yesterday, I'll ignore that, and I won't say what does this have to do with monetary policy. So thank you very much. The floor is open. I found both talks really exciting, and there are lots and lots of hands. Since we're already moving into the policy framework, I hope Philippe will grant us a little bit of time. Yes, Athanasios.
Athanasios. So the mandate of the ECB with respect to price stability is inflation between 0 and 2%, right? In New Keynesian models, it actually turns out that it is not easy to generate a positive average inflation target, an average inflation target that is above zero. When I'm saying that it is optimal to deviate from price stability, I'm actually talking about the fact that the model delivers an average inflation target in the range between 1 and 2%. And the deviations from price stability that the model generates in response to shocks, we're not talking about letting inflation increase to 15%. We're talking about deviations from this target that is exactly consistent with the mandate of the ECB that are perfectly plausible and within, you know, there's no big departure from price stability. Then I completely agree with you that like all models, it's not a photograph of reality. And it is also important, very important, to address the fiscal policy implications of these reforms. But I want to be very clear. When I talk about departing from price stability in terms of target and in terms of cyclical of response to the reforms themselves and to cyclical shocks, the numbers are, there's nothing wild going on. And there is actually a model that delivers, again, the target that is in the range of the ECB.
I had Carlo and then Paolo.
So every reference to optimality here meant maximization of the welfare of the representative household. In the case of, you know, cooperative of the Ramsey optimal cooperative policy, what we are doing is we are assuming that there is a Ramsey optimizing worldwide central banker that is choosing policy to maximize an average, a combination of the expected intertemporal utility functions of the home and foreign households. So in the monetary union model, the central bank of the monetary union is maximizing jointly the welfare of the households of the two countries of the monetary union. Now, we know from Mike Woodford's work that if we, you know, march through 180 pages of algebra, I can probably find a way of mapping those utility functions into loss functions that include arguments that are standard in the modeling, you know, in the way thinking about monetary policy making as minimizing a loss function defined over, say, inflation, output gap, and in the context of this somewhat more complicated model, probably some open economy variables. But optimality here really has to do with maximization of welfare. You know, we can decide to assign to policymakers objectives that differ from the utility function of the household, but that's a different concept of optimality. I'm not dogmatic about that. I would be actually curious to explore the implications of assuming differences in objectives across different policymakers and what they imply for their interaction and equilibrium outcomes. But the, with respect to standard, you know, macro modeling, the benchmark definition of optimality is the one we're using.
Paolo has a, no? Lots of questions late, maybe during the Pollux debate round or... any other questions here? I've one short one for Jim on the exporting, especially those simulations you did at the end of you change the exchange rate and you get kind of spontaneous creation of exporters. Do you think that's a curiosity, or do you think just the nature of the model and the costs and incentives for people to enter make that also a likely possibility?
Well, the exchange rate in that model is just an example of the kind of shock that might induce entry into a market. Another kind of shock that might induce entry would be somebody demonstrating the viability of the market. And that's actually what happened in Bangladesh.
Okay.
A Korean joint venture got demonstrated it could be done, and then there's this big whoosh all at once of everybody.
So that even would open the door for a director general of entrepreneurship to try to seed something.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be a credible signal. But it's not necessarily a market failure. It's just that this kind of phenomenon is possible.
So what's the failure that prevents? I mean, why does the seeding help? Just because it ends up lowering the search costs for the others and the uncertainty about the environment.
Yeah, I mean, if you know credibly that the market is viable, just announce it, right?
Okay.
You don't have to subsidize.
Okay. All right, well, I think we have a break till... Yeah, grab a coffee, do your whatever, and then come right back to the panel. Thank you very much for the speakers.